Check out my new book, Reach All Readers, at reachallreaders.com. When you pre-order, you'll get special access to my Science of Reading mini course. Learn more at reachallreaders.com. In today's episode, I talk with Dr. Lorraine Hammond. She is from Perth, Australia, an experienced lecturer and teacher, researcher, workshop facilitator, conference presenter, you name it. And I was privileged to hear her speak at the Plain Talk Conference, where she talked about a whole school approach to teaching vocabulary and also how to incorporate writing instruction into that. So we'll touch on a lot of things today, but that is the main focus of our conversation. Here we go. Welcome, Dr. Hammond.
Oh, hello, Anna. How lovely to be meeting with you.
Thank you so much for joining me. I really, really enjoyed the presentation that you gave at Plain Talk this winter about teaching writing. It was called Teaching Writing is Like a Magician's Hat. You have to put something in to get anything out. And I would love to talk today about teaching writing, and in particular, a theme of your presentation was integrating vocabulary instruction with writing instruction. So before we do that, could you introduce yourself and tell us about your career and what you're doing now?
Oh, well, I'm an associate professor in the School of Education, Edith Cowan University, which is in Western Australia, in Perth, which is considered the most isolated city in the world. We are a long way from everywhere else. So it was an absolute delight to make it to Plain Talk and to meet such wonderful people and listen to such great speakers. I've worked in the area of literacy for a very long time. Unlike you, who I think began as an early childhood teacher, I began as a secondary teacher and a fairly arrogant one at that, who thought that was the thing to do. I was exceptionally good at reading and writing, and that's why I chose to be a secondary teacher. And I'll make the point that, you know, being good at something is a big adult blind spot for us as teachers. And so I just assumed that everybody could read and write, and could they possibly just try a little bit harder? When I met lots of adolescents who couldn't read, I decided I'd need to go back to university and figure out how to teach reading in particular. So that has been very much my work since I began as a teacher. I have the great fortune these days to work across Australia in lots of different places, supporting the teaching of literacy and vocabulary, and writing is one of the things I enjoy supporting teachers to do the most.
So when you started learning about how to teach, was that a whole language time in Australia? Like, did you learn the wrong thing and have to relearn it, or were you in the right position?
I didn't learn anything, Anna. I was a secondary teacher, and unfortunately, and I work with secondary teachers now at my university, and in fact, I recorded the lecture on reading for them last night and wanted to explain to them how reading happens. So even if you're not that person, at least you understand how to do it or how to get help. So no, unfortunately, I think that many of the young people that I met in my first years of teaching were indeed the result of whole language, which was adopted with great enthusiasm across Australia. And I think many of them were largely instructional casualties. I was convinced they were all dyslexic at first, and of course they weren't. So no, I had to go back to university. And interestingly, I had to really study areas that weren't really readily available to anyone at the time, because very much the dominant way of teaching was whole language, which has now been replaced by balanced literacy. But I'm proud to say that my university, we have a reading position paper, and we take very much an evidence-based approach to the way that we prepare our graduates.
That's wonderful. Just like La Trobe.
Just like La Trobe, absolutely.
So, getting into writing, why is it that writing is such a challenging activity? You mentioned how when you're good at writing, it gives you a blind spot, and I've always enjoyed writing myself, and it is hard to break it down and to see what in particular makes it so hard. Lately, my two middle boys, they're in 8th and 6th grade, had to write a report for science, and so I actually did break it down with them based on things I'd read in the writing revolution, you know, things like, let's take our notes, let's write our topic sentences, let's put the notes and or the details under each one. And it helped a ton, but I normally wouldn't think about breaking it down that much. So what makes it so hard?
Well, and you use a really good example. I think for us, and if you even think about it from an adult perspective, as well as preparing lectures, I'm marking papers, and I'm asking my students at the moment to write about something that they don't know an awful lot about. So we think about what happens when you write. You need to have a topic in mind. You have to know what you're going to write about. Then when it comes to the putting of the pen to paper or the fingers to the keyboard, that's the first barrier for some young people. They have trouble with the act of writing or typing. They might be hunters and peckers, so they're very slow. So you're looking at accuracy around and fluency around handwriting, typing, then spelling. You know, can you actually spell those words? Can you string a good sentence together? Can you use a range of sentences? So we don't all want to read a simple sentence. We need some variability. Think about vocabulary, getting into combining sentences and the complexity of it. Then in your mind, you're having to hold all this information because your boys are writing something about science that they might not know terribly much about, so they have to construct. So there's an awful lot of secretarial skills that have to come together, as well as the fact that you're trying to hold all this information that you know and maybe unfamiliar in your head. And then, of course, if you're a university student, we ask you to reference as well. Mm-hmm. And that can really be the camel that breaks the straw that breaks the camel's back, because it's just too much going on. So I think that the more that you can put into long-term memory and automatize, the easier writing is. So if we can say, okay, handwriting is actually just happening automatically, children aren't worried about how to form letters, they're not struggling. If we think about punctuation, if that's automatic, then you're not having to think about, oh, I need a capital letter, I need end punctuation. If you think about even the genres, if you have in your head, as you would have in your head, okay, a report looks like this, or a narrative looks like this, all of this we are requiring students to do. So it's a very brave teacher who goes into a classroom, in my view, on a Monday, you know, not quite prepared and thinking, right, well, I'll just get them doing something, and says, okay, everybody, how about you do me a recount on what you did on the weekend? Well,
right.
Okay, well, while I locate, you know, the painkillers for my headache and get organized for the day. The problem being that, you know, a recount has a structure, and it has all those elements we just talked about, including probably four paragraphs, introduction, firstly, secondly, thirdly, maybe even, you know, a concluding paragraph. So there's all that language involved in it, as well as the spelling, everything. And for a lot of children, what you will simply get is, on the weekend, I played soccer, full stop. And that's as good as it's going to get. Mm-hmm. So knowing what that extended piece looks like, which you and I assume they would, no, they don't necessarily know. Right. So it is highly complex.
Yeah, when I look back to my writing in school, that is very familiar. Like, I just remember a lot of writing prompts, and I like to write and I like to read, so I think I did okay. But I remember writing finally came together for me when I was not till I was a senior in high school, when our teacher taught us how to write a thesis, and he just broke it all down, and there was a structure that I don't remember much about it, except that it made a lot of sense. And after that, I really, really enjoyed writing, like writing reports, because I understood how it all went together. But it took until I was like 17 before someone taught that to me.
Yeah, and I guess what you're saying and what I'm suggesting is possible with children of all ages is you're kind of showing them how the sausages are made. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that. I remember, maybe similarly to you, I was just really good at writing. And then somehow I found, it might have been at the library, and I think it might have been from a student who was much older than me, because I would have still been in primary or elementary school, as you would call it, this list of words like however, therefore, on the other hand. And I was like, oh, wow, this is great. I could use this in my writing. So like you, I was entirely self-taught. And I don't even remember anybody at high school even saying to me, okay, so you need an introduction. I was very much taught in the era of just keep writing, just write it down, and we will fix it up later. And if I think about my first year of teaching, one of the things that I did do, which in hindsight was really effective, because there's plenty that I did that wasn't terribly effective, I'm sure, was I said to my students, right, so we have to write an essay. So I'm going to write you the essay. I'm going to explain paragraph by paragraph what is going on. So I think at that point I'd had the epiphany and realized just because I can do it, they can't necessarily do it. So making it very clear for students, I think, is a great place to start.
Yeah, and that's one of the marks of a good teacher, is breaking things down to their smallest parts, which can be hard to do. You talked about in your presentation a school-wide approach to vocabulary instruction, which you combined with writing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Okay, so just I will get to writing, I do promise, in just a moment, but we'll just look at the value of teaching vocabulary for children and for their teachers. So for children, learning vocabulary, particularly, and I'll defer to Isabel Beck here, who I had the great fortune of hearing some years ago speak, you're teaching kids big words that they don't necessarily hear in spoken language, but they are likely to encounter in writing. And what we want them to do is to be able to read those words. So if you have that word already in your head and you know the meaning of the word and you know the spelling of the word, so here's an example, celiac, which is a shocker, Coeliac. If you're Australian or English, you have an easier time of it because it's Celiac. I've messed that up, but you know what I mean? It's much easier. It actually looks like celiac. So if you've heard the word celiac, 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 and then in the case, this is my son who at a very young age saw it on a menu and said to me, oh, I said, what's that word? What's that word? He said, it's celiac. I said, how do you know that? He said, well, at the end, it's got liac, liac, and it's a menu, and I think it's celiac. So having that word in his head enabled him to decode it. So it's great for decoding, very important. It's great for reading comprehension. But then, of course, it's going to improve the precision of your writing if you can choose better words. So I think if you're in the business of teaching anything well, vocabulary and writing go together really well. It can be hard for teachers to teach vocabulary. So if you think about business as normal, and I have to just mention my very very patient master student, Dr. Wendy Moore. So spoiler alert, she went through to do her PhD with me, who put up with me coming back from listening to Isabel Beck and saying, well, we should do something on vocabulary. This is really important. And you can imagine the withering look she gave me because she hadn't actually finished her master's at that point. And she said, okay, all right. So we ended up, you know, looking for words, and you realize that there aren't very many great words in the kind of books that teachers like to read to kids. So, you know, having a very structured approach to vocabulary is powerful. Teaming it up with writing is simply pragmatic for me. I know that many of my beginning teachers that I work with in schools struggle to know how to teach either vocabulary or a writing, and writing is a particular challenge for them. Sometimes they've come through university and they've simply learned about the stages of writing, and that you must present some sort of stimulus for the young people and they will write. They don't know the nuts and bolts of it. So combining the two is really pragmatic. You've hinted at an explicit approach where we break things down. Both of these topics, if you like, vocabulary and writing, can be broken down really well and taught regularly to students with great effect.
So when would you, I think you talked about starting this pretty early in a child's journey. So what grade would that be Australian and then translate for us for American?
Okay, so it depends where you live in Australia. So the young people that I would predominantly work with in schools come to school at the age of 4, and they do 2.5 days a week. So with very young children, well, you've got some choices. You might do something around a concept called shades of meaning. So you would teach the children, girls and boys, here are some synonyms for happy. Synonyms are words, they look different, they sound different, but they mean the same thing. Here are some synonyms for happy: happy, content, joyous, ecstatic, over the moon, on top of the world. They're idioms, girls and boys. And I'm borrowing the words of my colleague and friend Brooke Wardana here. When I put my hand down, I want everyone to tell me another word for happy, and they would call out their word. And then over the course of a week, you would teach all those words because they will have slightly different meanings and slightly different versions of happy. And then at the end, you'd actually rank them for the children. So content might be less happy than ecstatic or euphoric. So students would learn that there was a hierarchy, if you like, of happiness, and that's where you might start. Other schools would say, okay, for our children who are 5, which for us is called foundation, and it has various names across the states of Australia, but we would say pre-kindergarten maybe for you. So they're 5, it's their first year of formal school. We might have a theme, and the theme, say, might be pirates, and the students might be doing a word like scruffy, which is a word that they might necessarily know. So they'd be doing scruffy, and then they would just do one word across a week, working their way up to when they get through to year six, they would maybe be doing maybe 6 to 8 words a week. So as children work their way through the primary school experience, particularly in the schools that I work in, we would have one theme per week, and the themes have to be highly relevant to the students. So when I go to the Kimberley, we have Rodeo as a theme, because Rodeo is a really big deal in regional and remote Australia, but it's not such a big deal in a metropolitan school. So we might have something around a royal show or a circus, if you know that's an experience that the students are going to have.
So, and you, I think in your presentation, you talked about having the same theme for the whole school. Is that true? Across the grades, and then the words changed by the grade?
Yeah, so there is a theory behind that. And I guess when Dr. Wendy Moore and I were looking through children's books and realizing that there wasn't a lot of aspirational language in the kind of readers that, or the materials that teachers like to read to students. And if they were pulling out a word, they might do it in an incidental way and say, okay, here's, oh, this is an interesting word. And they would talk about the word and move on. And students' retention of that word and the meaning was very low. So, as I said, if you want to be serious about doing this, then you do have to put the prep work in beforehand. So, yes, schools who do it well, in my mind, have about, well, depending on when you want to start, we have roughly 40 weeks in a school term. So we would have 40 themes. And so they would run across the year. And, of course, if your school is doing something particular in a certain week, that might be Harmony Week. Or you may have, we have Taught Like a Pirate Week. If you're into Star Wars, May the 4th. So, you know, you have a variety of themes. But a lot of these themes are interchangeable in the sense that you can have heroes and villains, or you can have Star Wars. They're going to have very similar words. And then the next bit is you sitting down with your staff, although there's now a number of these kind of plans floating around on the internet. But this was pioneering work that I did, and I have to acknowledge Jordan O'Sullivan and Jared Bussell, two of my former students who went up to work in a school in regional Western Australia, and then having done amazing things there, came back to Perth and started up in a school that I'm the board chair of. So I've had a long relationship with this school. And they came up with this way of actually teaching vocab. As I said, it all started with Isabel Beck and my enthusiasm, but we fast realised that maybe determining the words beforehand was better than hoping that they might turn up in books. Mm-hmm. Also, if you think about some books, certain words will turn up a lot. And so it's better to perhaps have your own systematic approach to teaching it. So if I think about, you know, Talk Like a Pirate Week, we might have one word maybe when the children are in the first year of school, right the way through to maybe up to 8 words, 10 words, depending on how much time you're going to give this. So, yes, it is actually scoped out. And the words themselves, you will sit down with a bunch of teachers and it's quite miraculous. They'll go, no, no, that can't possibly be a year two word. That has to be a year three word, because it has this suffix at the end and we don't really do that to a year three. So let's put it there as opposed to year two. So there's a bit of shuffling around, but it means that if you're on week 12 of the school year, everybody's on the same theme. This means that the teachers know what the teacher before them would have been would have been teaching the children, as well as what's coming next. And the whole point, if you are going to go to the trouble of doing this, is to have the young people come out of elementary school with about 1,200 tier two words. So words that, as I said, are, you know, serendipitous, verdant, which means luscious and green, words that they might not necessarily encounter that they can then use also in their writing. So it's the prep beforehand, because not only do you need the words in place, you also need child-friendly definitions. Yeah. And that's the work of Isabel Beck. So we need to have really simplistic definitions. So if the word was malevolent, you would want the children to be able to know that, that mal means bad. It means really, really bad. And when we're treating that word, so again, if you think about, you know, the big five of reading, we know PA, phonics, fluency, vocabulary, comprehension. When they're very little, you're going to be spending a lot more time on the other elements as compared to vocabulary. But say with the word malevolent, that might come in at about year three or grade three or grade four. By that stage, you've eased up on the teaching of phonics, and it's now more about fluency. And so you can afford to spend more time on words, but a word like malevolent is still going to be broken down into syllables. It's going to be broken down into parts, and mal means bad. And we still want students to think about it because you want to spell the word as well. So, you know, I'm a big believer in, yes, there will still be elements of PA up the grades, but vocabulary is a great place to see it, because let's do something with that word rather than just try and remember it as a whole.
Can you walk us through a little bit what it would look like to teach a new word to really young kids? So like you were talking about the word ecstatic, like what might that look like?
Oh, well, if I was teaching the word ecstatic, so let's use the word euphoric, because I did this just recently. In a school. So I would say to very young children, euphoric means the happiest you have ever felt. And that would be a child-friendly definition. So I would have a PowerPoint slide. And the reason why I would have a series of slides is because when I go to a school, I leave those with the teachers. And then I say, use this as a template, because the template should always be the same. Please don't kill yourself coming up with really fancy, that they don't have to be, but there are certain non-negotiables. And again, this is the work of Jordan O'Sullivan and Jared Bussell, who've really honed down on what the most important elements are here. So first slide would be a picture of someone looking euphoric and the word euphoric. And I would say, girls and boys, the word is euphoric. What word? Euphoric. I'm going to break it down into its sounds, and we do syllables and sounds, and we talk about some antonyms and some synonyms. And then I would say, girls and boys, euphoric means the happiest you have ever felt. Girls and boys, tell your partner, what does euphoric mean? And that's when you start to embed that child-friendly definition. So then the next slide would be pictures, and they would be pictures of euphoric and not euphoric. So a picture of euphoric might be a picture of Disneyland. Going to Disneyland would make you feel euphoric. A non-euphoric would be a child looking at a bowl of broccoli. Okay, and the kids would go, oh, I would not be euphoric if I had to eat that. So what you're trying to do is build in the children's mind that it's not just about winning a trophy. It can be about lots of different things. So depending on the age of the children, there might then be some reading tasks. So if I'm going to go to the trouble of doing this, and also when the children would be responding, they'd be telling their partner, I would not feel euphoric if I had to eat a bowl of broccoli because, and they would have to justify that. Then we'd have some little sentences that they would be reading with me off the screen. So I'm going to get some fluency practice in there as well, and some decoding. And then they would all be examples of euphoric. And then it has to get to the point where I'm going to show students some pictures, and I'm going to say euphoric or not euphoric. And that really helps have a chat with their partner. So you're building up this idea that euphoric can be a number of things. What would then happen is a slide would come up, and it would ask the children when they have felt euphoric. So only at this point would I do that, because I'm pretty sure they know what euphoric is, and then they would tell me their answer. Then we'd swing into the next phase, which is going to be that sentence writing piece.
Okay.
So I would say to the children, we are going to write a who, what it did sentence. And I would have previously taught them that the who is a noun, that's in green, and the what it did is in red. And then I'd show them the teacher was euphoric because it was Friday. The teacher, you give them some examples. The boy was euphoric when he found out McDonald's were going to be building a store at the end of his street. So I actually work some examples, and they're color coded as well. And then finally, the students would have to write their own. And I would say, I felt euphoric when, and then they would finish the sentence. So that little routine, and I'd probably do a second word depending on the age range of the children, and they have to put that together as well. And possibly in the next lesson, they might combine those two words in a sentence. That routine doesn't take any more than about 15 to 20 minutes, but it's a consistent routine across the school. So the challenge for the teacher is the PowerPoints. Okay. So if you're just inserting pictures and you're writing some sentences, it's not too onerous. And you don't want the students to be wondering what's happening next, because it's a consistent PowerPoint. They know what the steps are here. They know what the steps are. And so it's, if done well, it's just part of business as normal. And sometimes with vocabulary, people will do it and then they'll just move on, but there's no opportunity for practice. So if that was my class and we did Euphoric Today, well, at the beginning of my little lesson, I would have a review of some of the words we've previously taught. Mm-hmm. And let's say we're coming to the end of term one here in Australia. So I'd be using words from week one, because yeah. I need to continuously be reminding the students. Because we have a game plan, the school knows, the teacher in the class knows, here are my words. And so what I'll typically do is I'll see them printed on a sheet of paper, laminated up, and they put them around the classroom as they complete each list. So that's a point of referral for the teacher to go, oh, I think you could use a better word than this. Yeah. Have a look. Mm-hmm. And also a reminder, and the students do look at it as well. You'll find that if you get into this, and I've seen this happen in lots of schools, suddenly groups will get names. So instead of the monkeys, there'll be the malicious monkeys. Malicious is one of the words. And schools have often then used some of this language, the positive language, on merit certificates. And I'm sure some parents are thinking, oh, my goodness, you know, I wonder what that word means. So there's a real attempt to embed it into what happens in the school.
Can you talk me through the difference in the application piece in the very at the very beginning, when they maybe don't even know their letters yet, versus, you know, the other end of elementary? How does the writing piece look? Is there any writing at all? And when does that start?
Well, I have to defer to Brooke Wardana here, and she came up with something that's been very effective. And she calls it QUIP, capital letter, one idea, end punctuation. Now, we're also very fond of the writing revolution, so we will have fragments versus sentences, and we'll do that orally with the children as well, because we're trying to establish with the youngest of children that Anna is... That's not a complete sentence. We need to know something about Anna. So from the beginning, they'll have a combination of sentences versus fragments, and they'll learn to identify, even if the teacher's reading it for them, what a sentence versus a fragment is. At the same time, children will be learning single sounds. So the simplest of sentences that they would write, and I would strongly advocate for having children actually writing sentences themselves rather than copying from the board, because I don't know that that necessarily tells an authentic story to everybody about how they're actually going. But imagine you've got a smattering of single sounds and you've learnt the irregular word I, which is going to be turning up a lot anyway in children's reading. You can write a sentence like, I like, and I'll have to give them like, but then they can listen to the word. The word can be cats, it can be dogs, it can be pigs, it can be frogs. And we will practice by putting out hoops, I like, and then they have to tell me the missing word. And we'll do lots of oral language practice, and then eventually the children will sit down and the word that they're going to be writing is a word that I know that they can spell. The single sounds will be on the board. I'll say, girls and boys, the word is dogs. Put that word in the air, dogs, and I'll point to the letters as I say it. Write that down. And so from the earliest stages, you're starting to get a complete sentence. At the same time, we'd say capital letter, one idea, end punctuation. Students would see simple sentences on the screen that would not have one of those elements, and they would have to identify which element was missing and add it. So from the earliest stages, it's possible, I think, to start teaching writing. And then gradually you can go from it. And I've been able to go in, and remember, I'm a secondary teacher, so if I can do it, you can. Particularly if you know your children better than I ever will. I've had to go in and teach a sentence structure that is a who, what, it, did, when. And so I've had to start at the very beginning with five-year-olds and say, okay, this is what a simple sentence is, capital letter, one idea, end punctuation. In fact, we might even have some sentences versus fragments first, then what the capital letter, one idea, end punctuation is, then here are some sentences. Are they? Because they're going to forget the capital letter, they're going to forget the end punctuation. And then I will model an example, and I'll get the children to the point where they can see the color coding and they can see what's happening, and they'll write there who, what it did, and then they'll put the when at the end, and I'll give them examples of the when. So from a very young age, you can teach this structure to children. Notice how I'm not using dependent clause, independent clause. You know, that is quite hard for some teachers at this point in time. I think it will get better. Yeah. And I love the work of William Van Cleve, and I think it's incredibly clever. But for some of my teachers, they're just not at that point right now because they don't know how to teach writing. So by seeing it color-coded, it really helps them and it helps the children as well.
So in your presentation, you talked about short writing often, long writing seldom. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Well, if you think about sitting down and writing a recount, you're not going to get there straight away. So if you have lots and lots of practice on a daily basis at writing, and I do like the writing revolution for many reasons, but because it says, look, teach them something and then have them write about it. So it's writing in the service of knowledge. So whatever you've been teaching students in any learning area, from kindergarten right the way through to high school, you can get students to write immediately about it, and that helps them with comprehension. So if you think about it, I want my students to use appositives. Okay. Now, I've taught this to very young children because you go to the very beginning, you go, okay, before we do our little lesson on appositives, and they're going to write a sentence containing an appositive, I'll do a quick review, because otherwise I'll have to prepare myself for disappointment because they will forget the capital letter, the M punctuation. So we'll go through the basic structure of a sentence, and the students will identify sentences, non-sentences, and so on. And then I'll introduce the concept of the appositive. Now, let's imagine we've been learning about the Great Barrier Reef. Okay, so I'm sure your audience would know that's a very famous natural wonder in Australia. So I have to set it up so the students are going to be writing about the Great Barrier Reef. And, you know, I can even, and I showed examples of this, I can have taught children some good vocabulary as well. Like I might teach them, you know, astonishing, remarkable, and I want them to use that in the appositive as well. So to bring all of this together, I'll teach them what an appositive is, how we can identify the nouns. So I have to pre-teach that beforehand just in case they've forgotten. So I stack up all the things that they need to know before we get to the lesson on appositives. And I've also taught them about the Great Barrier Reef. So I might say the Great Barrier Reef, and then they know that's the noun. They have to tell me something about the noun. They'll pull that information out from what we've just been learning. Is home to many astonishing and vibrant sea creatures. And so we'll get a really lovely sentence there. Now, if children are doing this on a daily basis and they're producing high-quality sentences, we can then glue all of that together to the point where we get to the recount, if you like, or maybe the narrative. So the schools that I work in have little formulas for narrative. They have little formulas for persuasive. So the children know that in the first paragraph of a narrative, you're probably going to have a bit of dialogue. So let's make sure we've practiced that bit, because dialogue is very hard for everybody, including adults. They don't know where to put everything. So dialogue's tricky. We might also have a sentence with an appositive in it. So let's make sure we've done that beforehand. So if children practice all these little sub-elements, and we say there's all these roughly five sentences in the introduction to a narrative, bit of dialogue. We need to know something about the character. They might be speaking out loud. Then we might say something about what they're looking at, and I might ask for a metaphor with that. So all these little elements can come together if the students have practiced. So it's about establishing some stamina for writing. And if you're doing it every day and you're just writing one or two quality sentences, that will then transfer over into writing. And I think that's one of the big difficulties for teachers, that they teach writing, but then it doesn't transfer over. Yeah. So whatever you've been teaching, you go straight into, and I with older students, I'd use because, but, so. I'd use the sentence kernel from the writing revolution. It's terrific. But, of course, we've got to get a basic sentence under control. So I might say to the students, right, so here's five words that we've been learning so far this year. I would like you to write me a when, comma, who, what it did sentence. And you'd be quite surprised, the students will take two of those words and they'll write a really great sentence because they know the structure. And the way that we program is we program it alongside the vocabulary words. And so a teacher who works in a high-performing school in Western Australia will go into the classroom and it will say, right, today we're doing this. These are our vocab words. Here are our sentence structures. And the vocab words will parallel the structures. So if you're working towards narrative, you might be using different words to if you're working towards persuasive. But what we're trying to do is to establish all these little sub-skills, you know, the meaning of the words, the spelling of the words, how to use them in sentences, how malevolent can be a witch, it can be the way you eat a biscuit, it can be if it's a tiny teddy. I don't know whether you have tiny teddies, we have tiny teddies, you know, you can chew their arms off, you can suck their legs off. So the children learn that that's malevolent, and maybe doing something horrible to someone at school is malevolent as well. So you want kids to have that understanding of the spelling of the word, the meaning of the word across different contexts. They need to see that word appear in sentences on the screen. Then they need opportunities to practice using that word. That's how you take it through to long-term memory, which is ultimately what we're trying to do here. We want those sentence structures to be automatic. We want students to automatically know how to do dialogue, how to automatically know how to use an appositive, and how to insert these really powerful words into the sentences as well.
So it sounds like you're talking about teaching, having a school-wide vocabulary program that is also the vehicle for teaching basic writing so that at some point they have accumulated the skills to do longer writing. Is that what you're
saying? That's right. That's right. And I think that writing can sometimes be an event in some classrooms, whereas I would not see it as an event. I would just see it as something that you did every day. I remember the people that I started working with many years ago, who are now principals in schools, my friend said to me, you know, I just get the kids to write every day. And then I have this record of how they are going. And she was very good. She taught them precisely how to write and she could see the development. So I think that what we do every day, we get good at. And I think the need to practice is very strong.
But I think some teachers might think they do writing every day. When I was in school, it was free writing, right? Just like, we'll give you 10 minutes, write. And we thought that somehow that was making kids better writers. But a lot of it was very sloppy. As a teacher, I know I did some of that. And I think I was supposed to be excited because they'd gotten so many words on the page. But I maybe didn't understand what they were writing, or, you know, they were proud of it, but I couldn't make any sense of it. So we want to make that writing time be purposeful. When I look back to, you know, the writing workshop model, which I think some elements of that are supported by research, but a lot of the writing workshop teaching that I did, certainly there wasn't much explicit instruction. It was just kind of what I thought we needed to cover that day. And it was mostly them writing and me just kind of looking, but not quite knowing what to say always. Do you think there is value in having that long period of writing like the writing workshop allows for, and if you do or don't, what, why, and how would that work?
Well, I think that there absolutely is a need for it. But if I, you know, I go back to the old days, I remember seeing the poster on the wall of, you know, parts of a paragraph, you know, a topic sentence, supporting details, colorful vocabulary, concluding sentence. Well, that means a lot to you and I, but it doesn't mean much to the children in front of us. Mm-hmm. So I think that we can learn from the fact that writing is complex. Students need a very structured approach, I think, to be effective at it. It really helps the weakest of students if they can see like the mystery behind writing. Mm-hmm. And I think, like you, I would have been guilty of just writing and assuming that everybody could do it as well as I could. So the idea that modelling is important, but it's a fairly passive activity for the students, and it's making an assumption that by watching you I'm going to get good at it. Whereas if we do take a little bit of control, and I'm not suggesting that the entire session would be explicit necessarily, but once they've got some sub-skills, mm-hmm. then they can get to a really good creative place. And certainly with the narrative structures and the persuasive structures that I've been talking about, people have said to me, oh, you know, doesn't it stifle their creativity? Well, no. If you can write a good paragraph or a good introductory paragraph to a narrative, and it can be a good paragraph, then you can change it up and you can make it great. Then your creativity can come to bear. But unfortunately, I think so many of our young people don't actually have that sub-skill there. And, you know, people talk about inquiry, and we've got a lot of inquiry-based learning going on in Australia. And inquiry is fine if you have the sub-skills to right. do it. And many of our young people don't have those sub-skills, writing a science report. These are all different genres. So I would suggest that a little block that would be writing in an Australian school that's following a high-impact instruction approach would start with a little daily review. And your daily review for writing, you should try and scoop up all those skills that you want the young people to apply to the final task. And the final task could be a dictation. So you know that they're going to be writing a dictation, and they will seem to have forgotten what to do with apostrophes of contraction, okay? So you might do a quick review on that. So the idea is, okay, we can do a quick daily review for writing. It might have some work on punctuation, grammar. If you were going to be asking the children to write a piece that's figurative, then you're going to be doing nouns, verbs, you're going to be taking adjectives, adverbs. So all of that will be stacked into that daily review. Then you'll come to the actual task. Now, sometimes you'll need a whole lesson. So I think that a lot of instruction around writing has to be very clear to the students. So compound sentences require a lot of effort because you need to know the meaning of the coordinating conjunctions. So that's going to be a lesson as well. At the end, I would like to think that you would be applying that knowledge in some way. And that would be the creative piece. That would be the narrative or the persuasive or the whatever that you were working on. And I think that would be a better workshop model than just writing. Just keep writing. Here's a stimulus picture. Just keep writing. Just keep writing. You can still have that stimulus picture at the end. And I use some pretty amazing pictures from Pobble 365. There's other places you can go. The last thing you really want to do is to say to the students, write about what you did at lunchtime.
Yes.
You don't necessarily want to know that. So you still need that stimulus picture there. It's just that you're taking a little bit more control as a teacher. And you're not going to be as disappointed at the end, I think, in terms of what's missing. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share about writing before we talk about maybe sharing resources where teachers can get ideas and helps for doing this?
I'll just say that excellence is never an accident. And every teacher that I work with who is good at teaching writing has figured out what's the first thing to do, what's the next thing to do. They have a game plan. And it's quite controlled. I think keep in mind it's always effortful. This is hard for young people. Just because we can write really well, it doesn't necessarily mean that they can. So breaking it down and providing multiple opportunities for practice is always going to be critical for me.
So you talked about how teachers have a game plan. Is there, I know people always want a scope and sequence for everything. Is there a place where teachers can go that can help them kind of map this out for themselves?
Yeah, there are. So it's currently archived, but there's a Science of Reading in Schools Facebook group that comes from Western Australia that has some excellent resources on it that people could download. I'm loath to say it, but if you were to contact me, I could certainly help you with this sequence. But I know the reach of your podcast is significant. So not all at once, people, but I'll certainly do my best. That's what people want. They really do want that scope and sequence. And that's a great place to start because you can look at the words and go, no, they're not going to work. But you'll rejig them and you'll make them work because you'll find alternatives. I think, again, if teachers see precisely how to do it, that is incredibly helpful.
Yeah, so just an encouragement to people who are listening, maybe to start thinking about putting a bug into people's ear at their school about possibly doing a whole school vocabulary program. And then also, if that's not going to work for now, teachers can certainly do this on their own, choose some themes for the week. As a starting point.
I should also mention that Anita Archer has some great videos on teaching vocabulary.
Yes.
And they're certainly something that I would use with older students. They're a great reference, and they're a download. They're an easy download.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for sharing this. This was a brand new idea for me, this idea of the whole school having a system for learning words, and then really smart to take that time and teach some basics about sentences, even in the early grades, through oral examples by the teacher. So thank you again. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Anna.
You can find the show notes for today's episode at themeasuredmom.com/episode 164. Talk to you next time.
That's all for this episode of Triple R Teaching. For more educational resources, visit Anna at her home base, themeasuredmom.com, and join our teaching community. We look forward to helping you reflect, refine, and recharge on the next episode of Triple R Teaching.